reporter Carl Harlan live near the Red and Black Cafe, where one officer who stopped in for coffee was simply asked to leave.
That's right, Jeff. We're here in a section of Southeast Portland, the Buckman neighborhood, where a lot of people who live here actually do feel preyed upon by Portland police.
I hope that the listeners of this radio show can appreciate that having institutions in our community that provide alternative viewpoints and provide space for anarchist ideas should be promoted.
Since this cafe is the center of a lot of people coming to talk about what's wrong in our society and people coming together to figure out how they can demonstrate, bring their grievances to the community, it's a place in which the police would have an interest. And I think it does make people feel uncomfortable for the police to be there. There's no reason for them to be here.
There is a fundamental problem with policing in this country. I think that not only the tragic murders of these people in Portland, but this isn't just a situation in Portland, Oregon. Oscar Grant was shot and killed by a uniformed officer in Oakland, California in the first hours of 2009. Tragic situation. He had his hands cuffed behind his back. He was completely subdued, and this officer drew a gun and shot him in the back.
Once Oscar Grant was killed, in an effort to try to figure out how this could have possibly happened. What could have happened? What went wrong? What could have gone through Johannes Messerli's head? You know, what kind of accident could have been? There were biographical articles about Messerli talking about how he was a gentle teenager growing up in the suburbs. And so what you notice is that all of these efforts to try to explain something away are rooted in a celebration of whiteness and a celebration of police culture.
We've had over 100 people since 2007 that have been documented to be murdered by the police, by the LAPD, in Southern California. And on top of that, too, we've also continually been threatened by the judge that any type of civil disobedience will lead to the trial either being moved to another county, so moving it to even further south in California, down to San Diego, where the community is even whiter, even richer, even less connected to what happened to Oscar, or just simply putting the trial on pause and waiting, and then kind of sweeping it under the rug. So LA, to some extent, has been bound by the judge and by wanting justice to come for Oscar Grant's family. We really cannot go out and have civil disobedience the way that Oakland has.
All these things we're trying to do so that communities don't feel like they need to rely on the police, especially for communities that right now can't. Even if they wanted to depend on the police, they couldn't.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll hear more from each of these people. John Langley from the Red and Black Cooperative Cafe in Portland.
George Chicarillo Marr from Oakland and Aaron Carter from Los Angeles. They are active in the struggle for justice for Oscar Grant.
Sarah Libby from Rose City Cop Watch and the Fire Frash Hour campaign.
And Andrew Barney from Youth for Alternatives to the Police. Stay tuned. Up first is John Langley from the Red and Black Cafe.
The Red and Black is an anarchist cafe that started in 2001 at 22nd and Division. A couple of years ago, we had to move, and we moved to our current location, 400 Southeast 12th. We're like a lot of cafes. We have coffee, a full food menu. Unlike a lot of other cafes, we don't have a boss. We don't have managers. We just do everything through consensus and through a collective and by having individuals that have certain areas of responsibility that are ultimately accountable to the collective. And then another big way that we're different is that we host radical events, benefits, film showings, book talks, stuff like that.
Could you describe the clientele of the Red and Black?
Since we're a vegan restaurant, we've got vegans who are all different types of people. In addition, houseless people that live on the street near the cafe because of where we're located, near St. Francis, which has meals every day. And so there's a lot of people living on the street nearby. We also have people who are doing different forms of political activism that come to have meetings or to do events there. So that could be animal liberation folks or environmental activists or various social justice activists. And then just regular people from the neighborhood. I think that's a decent explanation.
Officer Jim Crooker has worked in the Portland Police Bureau for 2 years, and in that time, he was never thrown out of a restaurant until he walked into this one.
I was working the counter, and I was looking down, and then I looked up, and there was a police officer standing across the counter from me. It really took me off guard. It made me feel really uncomfortable right away. The police officer ordered a cup of coffee that was half coffee, half hot cocoa, and I just made it for him. And then gave it to him, sold it to him for $2.50, and kind of felt gross about it. But then he started to walk away. And I'm like, all right, this is pretty much over. That was weird. Then he started talking to somebody at the front of the cafe, and I just became increasingly uncomfortable about it. Because we're an anarchist cafe, because many of the folks that come into the cafe and workers are not really excited about having police officers in the space. And so I went to ask him to leave, and he did. And then I got into a 20-minute conversation with the woman that he was talking to, Cornelia Senior, I believe, or Senior. She was very offended that I'd asked him to leave. I apologized, but I said I also stood behind asking this officer to leave. We started getting stuff on our Yelp review that we were noticing, people who had read her blog, who were very angry and gave us like 1-star reviews, who had never been to the cafe. That's when we started to see some kind of response. I'd say by June 4th, so maybe that's from the 18th until the 4th. It felt like it was going to probably end after that. I don't really know if she did press releases or exactly how that happened, but it built up steam and then became crazy last weekend with interviews. And then I contributed to it by hosting a press conference.
The reason I called this press conference was because I wanted to be able to respond to some of the criticisms that have been levied against me and the cafe in the wake of the media coverage. Because of the
issues that I brought up in the press conference was in response to people comparing keeping police out of the space to racial discrimination, which I felt the need to clarify the differences that I see between that and keeping a police-free zone. What I explained was that people of color are always people of color. They're discriminated against in many different aspects of their lives and throughout society. Police choose to become police, and they get away with stuff that other people aren't able to get away with. What I was trying to communicate was that the cafe is a safe space for people who don't feel comfortable around police. So we're going to side with the people that have less power and the people that are more in need of protection. And the police are not. They can get coffee anywhere. In many cases, they can get free coffee. So the second thing was just reiterating some of the legitimate reasons that people have to feel fear around police. And then the last thing was to talk about some alternatives to the police. The other folks that we invited, a couple people from Cop Watch, and they talked about the racist history of the Portland police and also talked about Keaton Otis and how, in Cop Watch's view, him being pulled over was an example of racial profiling, despite the police account that it was merely that he was slouching and that he had a hoodie. And then Ari from The Red and Black has been working on some aspect of the alternatives to police stuff. And so she talked a little bit about that.
Part of the mainstream media coverage is that people seem incredulous that a person could be uncomfortable by the police.
Right.
Why would people be uncomfortable with police presence?
I guess I can understand also where they're coming from, because I grew up feeling like the police were my friend and that they were going to make me safer, etc. And so I just want to say that. But I also want to say that the reason that people feel uncomfortable about the police is for a variety of different reasons. I guess one major reason is that part of the police's job is to enforce a lot of laws that people don't necessarily agree with. They, you know, the prisons are filled with people that have committed nonviolent offenses that in a more sane world would be medical issues or social issues, but wouldn't be criminal issues. Another big reason is that I personally have talked to houseless folks in the neighborhood about things that the police have done to them because they were sleeping in the wrong place or because they are powerless and they can be harassed, you know, like police spraying their stuff with water, police taking their stuff. And then there's just the fact that there's so many different activist groups, people doing direct action that come to the space who have a very contentious relationship with police because police have arrested folks basically because they're opposing the status quo and put them in jail for really long periods of time, which are totally out of proportion to anything that they are accused of, basically as a form of political repression. So I guess there's a bunch of different reasons that people don't feel comfortable around the police. It tends to break down also along class and race lines. I think that people who have middle-class lifestyles and are doing the normal stuff that are not really stepping outside of the bounds of society don't have to come up against some of the things that the police do that are really objectionable. Folks that are poor or have less power are very likely to come up against those things.
Here are voices of community members showing support for the Red and Black Cafe.
First of all, I just support the Red and Black in general. I really appreciate them as a community resource. But secondly, I think that police brutality is a really serious issue in our community. I mean, we've seen three police fatal shootings this year. And I think that it makes a lot of sense to have a place in the community where people can feel like they are safe from that sort of brutality. Like it's a place where people can live free from fear and enjoy a cup of coffee. And so I think the Red and Black really services members of the community who are marginalized in that way. And I appreciate that and I really want them to thrive. So I thought I would come out and support them.
I fully support as a person who has been brutalized by police, as a person who's seen other activist friends of mine and other communities completely damaged by cops in the neighborhood. I just wanted to let Red and Black know that I am so happy that this is one of the places that actually enforces their safer space policy. And I want to let the police know that I do not view them as being helpful to our community. I've worked in social services before. I've never seen them do a damn bit of good for poor people, homeless people, people of color, activist people, or anybody who's not toting the status quo.
And I just keep hearing more and more stories about people being murdered by the cops for no reason, other than the cops have guns and the people they're shooting don't. It's just really outrageous. The reason I'm out here today is because despite protests, despite people petitioning the police, the mayor, I mean, like going to the news, like there hasn't been this amount of outrage because a cop wasn't allowed to drink his chocolate milk in a cafe, making national news. I was just blown away. I just was like, really? You don't have anything that you can get outraged about? I could give you a list if you want to channel your energy into something that matters.
Since this cafe is the center of a lot of people coming to talk about what's wrong in our society and people coming together to figure out how they can demonstrate, bring their grievances to the community, it's a place in which the police would have an interest. And I think it does make people feel uncomfortable for the police to be there. There's no reason for them to be here.
Again, this is John Langley of the Red and Black Cafe.
Inside the cafe, it's been overwhelmingly positive, and it's been kind of actually overwhelming as somebody that works there. I've been sort of run ragged in the past several days because we don't generally need the staff to deal with that like level of business and people congratulating us and being extremely happy about the fact that it's a police-free zone. Outside the cafe, there have been some weird protests in front of the cafe. One of the days I opened, there was a couple of guys out there with signs that said police with a peace symbol for the O that were trying to talk to anybody who would listen about why they should boycott the cafe. I got to ask them if they had jobs, which was really exciting, because I've been on the other end of that so many times. But other kinds of responses have been, so there's this right-wing talk radio host. Her name is Victoria Taft. She had an event where she was giving away free free coffee to police. Then a bunch of counter-protesters showed up and were engaging in political theater on the street around that issue, and no police ever stopped by. There's going to be a free meat kind of thing that's going to happen in front of the cafe. And so there's also going to be some kind of response to that. On the internet, there's been a lot of people that are very angry about the situation. We've gotten a lot of phone calls, a few threats, like about 5 threats. It's been kind of crazy. I hope that the listeners of this radio show can appreciate that having institutions in our community that provide alternative viewpoints and provide space for anarchist ideas should be promoted. And so whatever people feel moved to do.
By Portland police. The officer was asked, as you mentioned, to leave the Red and Black Cafe here at the corner of Southeast 12th and Oak. Now, how people feel about this depends really on who you ask.
Something that I've been reflecting on in the past couple of days is that it's insane the amount of media attention that this one event has fostered compared to, for example, police killing people like James Chassie or Aaron Campbell or any of the number of other people that have been killed. I mean, they've definitely made local or maybe Oregon media, but I don't believe that it's reached national media. Why is that? Why is asking a police officer to leave a business a bigger news story than police shooting unarmed people? The reason is that that's a lot more normal than police being asked to leave a business.
That was John Langley, co-owner of the Red and Black Collective Cafe in Portland. You're listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7.
Next up, we turn to George Chicarillo Marr and Aaron Carter to talk about the struggle for justice for Oscar Grant.
The trial of Johannes Messerly is underway in Los Angeles. Messerly, a BART police officer, shot and killed Oscar Grant at the Fruitvale Transit Station in Oakland, California, on January 1st, 2009.
My name is George Chicarillo Marr, and I have a recent PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, in political science. I've been following pretty closely the Oscar Grant killing, the aftermath, the rebellions, and now the trial from Oakland, and publishing on that at counterpunch.org. And essentially what we see in terms of the background for the trial is the fact that on January 1st, as most people know, at least in Oakland, by now in LA and hopefully across the country, in the early hours of January 1st, Oscar Grant was pulled off a BART train in Oakland and shot in the back eventually by transit officer Johannes Messerly. And the reality that is probably less well known is the fact that Johannes Messerly was behind bars and is only facing the trial that he's engaged in right now as a result of the rebellions that took place in 3 weeks in the aftermath of that shooting. Before that, there was no effort to even arrest Messerly. There was hardly even an effort to discipline him on the part of the BART leadership. He was asked questions, and when finally it became obvious that more questions were forthcoming, he resigned. And now, as a result of these rebellions, we do have Johannes Messerly on trial. However, the one question that remains outstanding is whether or not he will actually be facing a murder charge in the end, or whether he will be allowed to have access to a manslaughter charge.
My name is Aaron Carter. I am a graduate student at UCLA working on a PhD in political science as well. So I'm in Los Angeles. We heard about what was going on in Oakland, heard about rebellions, and the way that Los Angeles kind of becomes or plays a part in the Oscar Grant trial, or the trial for justice for Oscar Grant, is that the trial is actually moved to LA, purposely done by the defense, right? They attempted to move it to either San Diego or Los Angeles because they said that Oakland would not be able to give him a fair trial. And so we have it down in here in LA specifically because the defense attorneys thought that no one in LA knew anything about this trial. So now we're dealing with the ramifications of that. We're dealing with a judge for the trial that's one of the Rampart judges, which I don't know if anybody knows a lot about that up in Portland, but Rampart was a huge scandal in Los Angeles where police officers were convicted of murdering brown and black and poor folks in the streets, selling drugs, kind of the gamut of that. And so the judge that we have now is the same judge that allowed those officers to essentially get off of those charges. So that's what we're experiencing down here. The hope has been, at least from the defensive side, that apathy towards police violence in Los Angeles will lead to him either getting off or getting a
lower charges, including manslaughter.
So because the rebellions have had such a strong ramification, can you describe a little bit more of what they looked like in Oakland?
Essentially, what we had was a delayed reaction to the shooting of Oscar Grant. And it was delayed precisely because it was not a reaction so much to the shooting as to the lack of action on the part of the district attorney, on the part of the BART, you know, the BART bureaucracy. So what we had is essentially 1 week after the shooting of Oscar Grant, a mobilization was called to the Fruitvale station where he had been shot. And about 500 people gathered there at that point, and the anger was palpable. I mean, there were people who were demanding more than action, if we could put it that way. And eventually, most of that crowd took off on an unpermitted march through Oakland toward downtown and eventually toward the BART headquarters. And at some point, that turned into a more militant rebellion when a police car was nearly turned over and nearly lit on fire, and when fires in the street and the destruction of cars commenced, something which lasted then for several hours until there were about 100 arrests. And this all in response to the lack of action by the state against Johannes Messerli and the outrage the community felt, not only at the shooting, but at the fact that the state obviously didn't care at all about the fact that another black or brown person had lost his life. And then this repeated the next week, and then 2 weeks after that, there were two more rebellions, each caused by different things. The subsequent rebellion on January 14th of 2009 resulted from the fact that people were still demanding justice after the first rebellion, and it had not come yet. So a mobilization was called for January 14th, at which point the state, realizing that they could be facing yet another night of rebellions, moved very quickly. And this came through, for example, Jerry Brown, the state attorney general, putting heavy pressure on the local district attorney to bring charges against and arrest Messerli. And this actually happened. Messerli had left the state, but he was then arrested the day of this mobilization. It was called for January 14th. And despite the fact everyone at the mobilization knew that he had been arrested, the doubt was such that he would face any kind of justice that people rebelled again. And then finally, on January 30th, which is to say exactly 2 weeks after that, was the day that Messerli was granted bail. And the bail was very high. People were actually surprised by how high the bail was set, and it was unclear for a while whether or not he'd actually be able to post that bail. But the very fact that he was given bail caused yet another rebellion in the streets of Oakland. So we had three rebellions in the month of January of 2009.
I think Los Angeles, to some extent, is dealing with the back end of that. So when the trial was moved from Oakland to Los Angeles, there have been a number of, I would describe them as kind of veiled threats from the judge about civil disobedience and about, quote-unquote, denying Johannes Messerli freedom and respect and safety, which we found to be ironic given the actions that he's accused of and the actions that we know he committed. So Los Angeles is essentially, the community out here is dealing with things kind of twofold. One, we've had over 100 people since 2007 that have been documented to be murdered by the police, by the LAPD, in Southern California. And on top of that, two, we've also continually been threatened by the judge that any type of civil disobedience will lead to the trial either being moved to another county, so moving it to even further south in California, down to San Diego, where the community is even wider, even richer, even less connected to what happened to Oscar, or just simply putting the trial on pause and waiting, and then kind of sweeping it under the rug. So LA, to some extent, has been bound by the judge and by wanting justice to come for Oscar Grant's family. We really cannot go out and have civil disobedience the way that Oakland has without potentially putting this trial either in another place where it can continue to be kind of swept under the rug or simply put on pause indefinitely.
Can you just both comment about the importance of people having some understanding of what kind of brutality communities are facing? And I know that doesn't happen a lot in the court system, but if you could just talk a little bit more about that.
I've been in the courtroom watching the trials since it's come to Los Angeles, and we've seen that firsthand in some of the witnesses that we've seen thus far. You know, people are experiencing police in different ways. We had two young black folks come in and talk about the threat that they're feeling from the police. I think there was a middle-aged Asian male who came to give an interview, was one of the people that videotaped one of the interviews. And you could just tell the difference in their experience with the police. At one time, the defense attorney, Michael Raines, asked one of the young black men who was on the trial, well, why did you guys run away? And the young man responds, we saw really scary, angry white faces in uniforms coming after us. And there's this kind of pause in the trial where Raines doesn't seem to kind of understand why that would make someone run. The older Asian gentleman who was on the stand said that he thought that Oscar was, quote-unquote, resisting arrest. And they asked him, well, how did he resist arrest? And they said, well, he said something to the police. In those kind of places, right, you're seeing this completely different relationship with the police. This older gentleman couldn't possibly understand why they would be frightened of the police, why they would not see them as being people that are bringing safety and justice to their community. And that's what's at the core with this problem. So we've seen it at least with the witnesses. I know that Gio's probably seen it in a variety of different ways, too.
Yeah, I would just speak to that in terms of the general dynamics of what's played out. And it's got to do with the relationship to the police, but also, of course, to white supremacy and the fact that the two are very complicit with one another, and that these two elements play out in part through the media. So what happened from the beginning, essentially, was that the media jumped in real quick once Oscar Grant was killed in an effort to try to figure out how this could have possibly happened. What could have happened? What went wrong? What could have gone through Johannes Messerli's head? You know, what kind of accident it could have been? There were biographical articles about Messerli talking about how he was a gentle teenager growing up in the suburbs. And so what you notice is that all of these efforts to try to explain something away are rooted in a celebration of whiteness and a celebration of police culture. Because, you know, when you turn the tables and when you put the gun in the other hand, you will see obviously no effort to try to explain what has happened. It's really merely the expected action of a sort of savage black or brown teenager from whom no one respects anything else but violence. But when all of a sudden it's someone who's white, and especially when that white person is a cop, then you start to find the media jumping in to try to explain things away. And this is something that is moving into as well the media strategy that Michael Raines has been using. And it may sound funny to say the defense attorney is using a media strategy, but Michael Raines has been trying this case in the media for months now, even when a gag order was in effect. He was leaking things to the press, and then the press was essentially passing those things on directly to the public in a way to manipulate public opinion with regard to this trial. And that might be hard to do under normal circumstances, but when you have a circumstance in which it's a white police officer, the press and the public beat this stuff up like cake. And so what we see again is this triangle of police power, of white supremacy, and of the media that has been essentially playing the role of arbiter in this case from the very beginning.
I think along with that, we see that same dynamic that Gio's talking about express itself in the trial itself. So Judge Perry, during the pretrial motions, spent a number of days talking about providing safety for Johannes Messerli's family, specifically his young daughter. But you don't see the same type of worry being granted to Oscar Grant, right? Who also had a young daughter, who also had a family, who was also with his friends and his cousins. So you're seeing that happen at the same time. No one is talking about Oscar Grant's daughter and the fact that she will live the rest of her life, both without her father and a video of her father's murder that will follow her. No one's begun to talk about that. So you're seeing it playing out in a variety of different ways, I think, both in the media and then in the trial itself.
Talking about the media, this is from a faraway perspective, so I'm not really sure, is that there was a lot of people who also then tried to speak for black youth.
This is something that played out in the context of the actual rebellions themselves, which were accompanied by a great deal of debate within the black and brown community, within the leftist community, and with relation to this nonprofit structure that exists in Oakland. What we had initially is a whole bunch of almost entirely young people of color, and it's important to say young there, running wild and smashing as a sign of resistance to what had happened to Oscar Grant, to the inaction of the state. And what you have is a whole bunch of other folks jumping in and trying to speak for these people. On the one hand, explain to the youth why they shouldn't be doing this, and on the other hand, trying to explain that it wasn't actually these youngsters who were involved. This came in the form of blaming white anarchists for misleading those who took part in the rebellions, which is an incredibly paternalistic way of looking at one's own community, where you think that they actually don't have the capability of autonomous action and that they have to respond only to these so-called outside agitators. And on the other hand, trying to explain to these young people that there are better ways to express themselves, when in reality, you know, the best and most effective way of expressing the anger at Oscar Grant's killing and the inaction of the district attorney was what took place precisely. You know, this is visible in the fact that people will deny this all day long, but it's absolutely undeniable that the only reason that Johannes Messerli is in jail is because there was a rebellion. Not from petitions, not from people trying to talk to the mayor, not from people trying to plead the case and, you know, argue rationally that this was a murder that needs to be prosecuted, but it came from the fear of more rebellion. And so in a way, what you see is these people who are being preached to, these young people who feel in a very sort of visceral way the power of the state every day and who encounter the police every day, in a way without knowing necessarily what the effects were going to be, these people took what was the most effective mode of action at that moment. And this despite the fact that all the experts and all of the nonprofits that stepped in claimed to know what would be the most effective way of addressing this case. when I say youth, I mean something I think broader than just age. It has to do with clothing style, with the circle of people that, you know, that someone runs with, which also intersects in some ways with class. But I would say that the age of the participants in the rebellion, from what I observed, centered right around, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old. And these were the people that, even when the non-profiteers were trying to remove people from the street on January 14th physically, they were trying to actually push people off the street and prevent people from continuing to rebel. The average age of those people who wanted to continue to rebel was definitely in the teens, the late teen years.
From the LA perspective, or just from a more top-down perspective too, you know, we've seen quote-unquote black leaders, you know, I'll throw out names like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. They're just kind of the names that, like, the media unfortunately uses in saying these are black leaders. There's a bunch of critiques of those folks as well that I don't think we have time to kind of sit here and talk about, but we've yet to even see kind of significant response from them. So even when talking with folks in LA, one, that was what they expected to happen. So they've been around. I did some work about 5 years ago on a man who was shot. He was shot at 120 times by the LA Sheriff's Department in Compton. And it was the same reaction there that it was here, right? We know that Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton are kind of, you know, what they're classifying as mainstream black leaders will come down here. They'll have a church service, they'll raise funds, and we won't see them again. And so in the community, especially in LA, because that's happened so often, there is this distance or this kind of lack of trust, at least from a top-down approach, right, from those kind of big national, quote-unquote, leaders, that they'll get anything done. So there's been that reaction, too, in Los Angeles.
I wanted to hear some of your comments about the importance of getting a conviction against Messerly, especially from the perspective of people who are critical of the prison system.
There's been a big error with regard to this whole case by what are called prison abolitionists, who in a way have been thrown into a complicated position by trying to figure out where they stand with regard to trying to send someone to prison. And I think the rigid, formal approach to prison abolition that has emerged is insufficient, which is to say the belief that, you know, we don't actually really want anyone to go to jail. And the reality is that the industrial complex was not created to send white cops to jail. It wasn't even created to send white people to jail. And so it's very, very hard to understand how sending a white cop to jail would be anything but a step toward prison abolition. Why? Because these white police are precisely the arbiters on the street of race and of the color line, and of specifically the fact that what their job is to send black and brown people to jail in order to maintain a certain kind of social equilibrium. And if we are restricting their ability to police and their ability to enforce racism and white supremacy by, for example, putting any limitations on how they can use their weapons, and by telling them if they use their weapons in an improper way, they'll go to jail, this is already a step toward limiting their capacity to enforce white supremacy and their capacity to maintain the prison industrial complex.
Along with that, too, I think if thought about in the proper way, I think this is another example of a dual power strategy, right? It's a strategy that both challenges institutional structures that are causing oppression in the United States and across the world, right? And we know that in the United States, that is the prison system, right? The prison industrial complex, like Gio's talking about. So I think it both challenges that by challenging the people that are instituting it, right? We're challenging police with it. But I also think that what we're hoping will be that the next step will be not only challenging those institutions, but then getting together in the community and providing alternatives. And this is something that we've talked about in LA, we talked about in Oakland, talked about in Portland. It's being talked about around the country, and we talked about it for decades. How do we provide people justice in our community without the police?
I think that's absolutely right. And just to add something real quick is that, of course, the danger is that we pay too much attention to the conviction of this one person and that we think that if he were somehow miraculously convicted of murder, that this would constitute, you know, a victory. And in a way it is. We have to see all of these things in a complex way, though. If Messerly were convicted of murder, for example, that would be a victory of ours. It would be a very serious victory, and it would be kind of an unprecedented victory in the state of California, at least. However, if we see that as a victory, the danger is that we'll see that as a victory for the justice system. And that's a very, very misleading approach, and that's something that we need to avoid. Something else that's worth noting is the fact that a manslaughter conviction is still a very distinct possibility in this case. And if a manslaughter conviction comes out, well, you know, if that's the actual result, people need to realize that that's a very successful attempt by the state and by the powers that be to maintain the current state of affairs by slapping a murderous cop on the wrists and by essentially washing their hands of the whole whole situation. In reality, only a murder conviction is sufficient in this case. And manslaughter, we would expect that people will respond to manslaughter conviction in the same way they would respond to an acquittal.
And the foundations of the manslaughter charge in general, re-pulled the ideas of white supremacy, right, and the kind of blindness of whiteness. I've seen Reins, I think, do this in the first 2 days of the trial. Every witness that he's had, he's noted that Mesrilli looked shocked after he shot Oscar Grant, quote-unquote, right? The only way that he can be shocked, right, is that he lives in this blindness that whiteness constructs, where he is shocked by the violence that the police can perpetrate on people of color and on poor folks, right? And any brown person, any black person, any person that's poor and living in one of these communities isn't shocked by this, isn't shocked by the police shooting a unarmed black man in the back on New Year's Day for no damn reason. We're not shocked about that. The only way you can be shocked by that is by living in these holes of whiteness where you can't see what's going on around you.
I think that's true, and that actually reflects in a very precise way the reactions that we saw in Oakland as well. On the one hand, you saw a certain sector responding with shock and anger to the killing of Oscar Grant, which is to say the sector that doesn't encounter such things every day. On the other hand, you see, you know, communities of color, especially working class communities of color, responded with just anger and, you know, the recognition that there's nothing new in what happened. And those two responses to the killing give rise to a very different politics, which we then saw played out in the various sectoral conflicts within the movement.
You're listening to an interview with George Chicarello Marr and Aaron Carter. Aaron is a graduate student in Los Angeles and is attending the trial of Johannes Mesrilli, who shot and killed Oscar Grant on January 1st, 2009. You can find George's articles and analysis about the community response to Oscar Grant's murder on counterpunch.org. This is Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7 in Portland.
I was in the courtroom on Friday, and they had one of Oscar's friends. He was 15 at the time of the shooting. He's 16 now, and he was one of the young men who videotaped, who has a videotape of it. And he's sitting on the witness stand, and he gives his testimony about a man who he described as his brother. Right? They ask him, what is your relation to Oscar? He says, I thought of him as my brother. And we see this young boy watch his best friend get murdered on this video, and he breaks down, and he starts bawling. To the point where his mother, who's also in the courtroom, they take a break, and she, crying as well, comes up and holds him. And I think that that moment was something that we haven't really talked about, and that is the fact that at least seven of Oscar's friends were witnesses to his murder. It's January 1st, it's New Year's Eve, or New Year's Day, I think at that time, on the BART. There are hundreds of people on that train. We haven't talked about the collective trauma poor folks, people of color, are facing from the amount of violence that's going on in our communities. And that's something that that boy will have to deal with for the rest of his life. And it will impact everything around him. It will impact his children and his children's children. And that's something that's scary because it's a part of the story that we haven't begun to talk about and we haven't even begun to address. You know, how do we address the issues of post-traumatic stress and just trauma that poor folks and people of color are going through in their communities, specifically because of police violence and white supremacy?
We haven't touched yet on the jury selection, which was recently completed and which yielded a jury for this case in Los Angeles County, which makes it shocking enough, a jury with no black people represented on it. And aside from being just shocking, this is a display of both the strategy employed by white supremacy in jury trials, which is to say we saw five black jurors dismissed at the last minute, essentially because they were black, and because it would be expected that they might have some sympathy with the victim. On the other hand, you see at the same time, an indication ahead of time of the way this trial is going to end up, in the sense that this jury selection massively increased the ability of Michael Reins to accomplish his objective, which is an acquittal for Johannes Mesrilli. I mean, the chances of that can go up massively, which in turn raises the chances that there'll be another rebellion on the streets of Oakland and Los Angeles, possibly.
People who are not in Oakland or Los Angeles, what can we do to help support the cause and the case?
First and foremost, people need to know about it. And that's the thing that we've been trying to kind of do. And I think beyond that, though, we need to start connecting the stories of struggle. So, you know, I know especially in the Pacific Northwest here, you know, between Los Angeles, Oakland, Portland, Seattle, there are a number of stories that are essentially the same, that just change, you know, you just change the city. You know, the story of Aaron Campbell is similar to the story of Oscar Grant, is similar to the story of a number of people of color that have been killed by the police. So I think, you know, part of it is trying to figure out a way to integrate those all into one collective struggle to get the police out of our communities.
I think that's absolutely right. And to add on to that, what people should do if this is something that interests them is to plug into their local organizations. I know, for example, that Rose City Cop Watch is doing groundbreaking work, not only in resisting the police, but also in establishing and in documenting and pioneering alternatives to policing, you know, alternatives so that the police, when they leave our neighborhoods, it doesn't mean there's nothing being taken care of in the neighborhood. It means you establish alternative structures that can provide the services that the police were allegedly integrating the community to provide.
That was George Chicarillo Marr and Aaron Carter. You are listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Next up, we have Andrew Barney from Youth for Alternatives to the Police, also known as YAP.
We're a new Portland working group that formed in the aftermath of the Aaron Campbell shooting. A group of us decided we wanted to do something originally with a youth focus, so that's where the name came from. We're not really so much a youth-centered group anymore. Basically, what we're trying to do is, if there are groups like the Fire Frash Hour campaign and other like progressive liberal groups which are trying to reform the system and push back against the system, and then there are groups like Rose City Cop Watch which are trying to make sure cops stay in line on the streets, we kind of see ourselves as like the third leg of that, actually trying to help communities create alternatives so that we don't just have to push back against the police, but actually make them obsolete.
So what kind of alternatives has your group talked about or supported?
I think when a lot of people think of alternatives to the police, they think of a community-based imitation of them, which I don't think is very appropriate. It's the same way people talk about anarchism, like why hasn't there ever been an anarchist country? Alternatives to the police wouldn't just be an imitation of the police. There's no way we could have alternatives to the police that fill all the functions people want the police to fill and have none of the bad parts and have it still look the same. So we aren't trying to do that so much as look at why people, some people with very good intentions, some people, very sensible people, feel that we still need the police. Looking at those reasons and saying which ones are like legitimate, which ones aren't. And some of the reasons we have police to prevent theft of property from people with lots of it by people who don't have any. That's obviously something that could be remedied in the sort of society that a lot of us want to see. But there are other things which would still pose problems. Looking at these root problems that we allow ourselves to have in our society because the idea is, oh, well, if it gets too bad, the police will step in. We don't really need to address sexism because if it really gets bad, the police will come in. We don't really need to address racism because if it's really bad, the police will come in. And what we're trying to do is say, no, let's look at these problems through the lens of building alternatives to the police. So what our group is trying to do now is we're trying to have community workshop presentation events in real community areas, not just activist areas, where we'll bring in speakers and presentations and resources relating to conflict resolution, sexual assault and domestic violence, anti-discrimination from transphobia to racism to anything else, to unarmed personal self-defense, women's self-defense, mental health issues, preserving your own mental health, how to deal with someone in a mental health crisis, and cop watching. All these things we're trying to do so that communities don't feel like they need to rely on the police, especially for communities that right now can't. Even if they wanted to depend on the police, they couldn't. Whether it's people who are sex workers, homeless youth, illegal immigrants, these people already have no access to the police. And many other people feel like they can't trust the police, they can't depend on the police, whether it's activists or poor people of color. And especially targeting these people and bringing these resources to them and then asking them, where do you want to go from here? We can provide resources for you if you'd like. Here are our sources. What do you want to do? So both using it to bring resources to people who might need it, but also using it as a launching pad for communities who want to go further, who want to keep these sorts of programs going.
Have you got any workshops set up?
So we don't have any events scheduled right now. What we're trying to do is build a speakers bureau of people who would be willing to talk on those six topics: mental health, cop watching, anti-discrimination, sexual assault, domestic violence, conflict resolution, and then taking people who would be willing to lead like half hour, 45 minute workshops in these areas And then also looking at very public community spaces, whether it's a church basement or a community center or a park. And then once we've compiled these resources, we're just going to try to put it together, basically. So we're still working on this. But if anyone has skills in these areas or would just like to be involved, we're a completely open organization. So you can contact us at youthaltcops@gmail.com. That's youthaltcops@gmail.com, or find us on Facebook under Youth for Alternatives to the Police.
In the work that you've been doing as far as researching these things, have there been models?
Rose City Cop Watch put out a great booklet on communities that have done things like this, which is available on their website. As far as what we're doing, I think it's really beneficial to look at it not like, if we can't call the cops, what do we do? Whether it's, you know, feminist groups educating people about the roots of domestic violence or people doing anti-discrimination workshops. I think a lot of this work has been ongoing for the last half century in the U.S. It just might not be on a lot of our radars as activists because it isn't in this framework of framing it as alternatives to the police. Even for people who are thinking, you know, we still need the police on some level, I would say even if you're one of those people, you should still be supporting programs like this. Wouldn't you still want to reduce the incidence of rape or of discrimination or of gang violence? What YAP is really trying to do is trying to show people concretely with our own lives, our programs. So it's not just words on a page. It's actually demonstrating to people, this is what people have done in the past. These resources and skills and people are out there. So that's basically what Youth for Alternatives to the Police is trying to do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
On June 11th at 4 p.m., a crowd of about 60 to 75 Portland residents protested in front of City Hall to demand Mayor Sam Adams respond to the three demands of the Fire Frash Hour campaign. This is Sarah Libby of the Fire Frash Hour campaign.
This speaks to the history of Portland. As folks know, Aaron Campbell was shot in the back and killed by Portland police officers in January, and Ronald Frash Hour was the shooter in that case. The Fire Frash Hour group came together shortly after that, after the murder of Jack Collins, before the murder of Keaton Otis, because there was a lot of outrage from residents of Portland about the lack of accountability when officers kill people on the job. So the campaign has come together around some specific demands about what we want, and that is the firing of Officer Humphreys, Frash Hour, Walters, and all killer cops to keep contract negotiations between the City of Portland and the Portland Police Association open and not closed, and to end mandatory arbitration for killer cops. For folks who aren't familiar with mandatory arbitration, I'm not going to be able to get into the details of the contract, but mandatory arbitration acts as something that enables officers to circumvent discipline and keep their jobs. Because of the police association contract, if an officer is disciplined or reassigned somewhere through mandatory arbitration, they can be reassigned, put back into active duty. And we just feel like it circumvents discipline and prevents any kind of really true accountability for somebody who may make an egregious mistake on their job that harms somebody, may end their life. So we think that that's a specific part of the police association contract that needs immediate change. This goes back to the killing of Jose Mejia, of Kendra James, of James Jahar, of James Chassie. I'm sure there are other people whose names I'm not going to be referencing today, Dickie Dow. There's unfortunately too many to mention. But there isn't any real kind of accountability or discipline that these officers have had to face for bringing this kind of violence and lack of safety for many of our citizens when they are in a moment of crisis.
This rally occurred after the Fire Frash Hour campaign held neighborhood rallies in Northeast Portland over the past 2 weeks.
These recordings were made at the Fire Frash Hour rally, June 11th, at Portland City Hall.
For many years, I've had some concerns about the police's way of policing us, and that they're dangerous, and there seems to be some bigotry going on, and I've seen it way back since the possum throwing and the choke chokehold killing and the t-shirts being made, I believe, by the police and just all through the years. So I heard that this is all going on, and I went to a Unity Forum and Unity Church Forum and thought I'd come down here and speak my piece, I guess. Sorry.
Great, thank you. So have you been involved in police accountability work before?
No.
This is your first time?
Yes.
So do you think there's something different about this time in particular?
I've just been hearing so much on the news about another person getting shot, another person getting killed, a 12-year-old, I'm not sure where she was, being tasered over and over, and just things that they're out of hand. Something needs to be done. People need to speak up.
So for you, what would real police accountability mean?
Well, I agree that the public and the citizens need to be part of, and I believe that we need to all be watching. I believe there needs to be regulation. I think they need new training so that they don't make people so angry. They seem to have attitudes that seem to advance violence.
The Fire Frosh Hour campaign really feels that because of the lack of safety and the fear in the community that the Portland Police Association members, that cops on the beat, have created in this city, that it's their responsibility, that they need to take care of it. And frankly, if you read the Portland Police Association rap sheet, I've seen a lot of really disturbing language in terms of some very frankly racist, no way around it, language articles, and also a lot of fear about the people who they are, quote unquote, here to serve. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of language saying that they're so fearful of all of the people in the community.
That was Sarah Libby, and we go back to audio recorded at the Fire Frosh Hour protest in front of Portland City Hall, June 11th.
Demand accountability from the Portland Police Department. Demand that contract negotiations stay open to the public and to get rid of binding arbitration for the police department.
What does real accountability look like to you?
To me, it means that when cops kill people in the community, that they immediately get fired, potentially face legal repercussions. A demand that the Portland Police Association cannot hold their contract negotiations behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you tell me a little bit more about the closed door contract negotiations?
The initial session, the Portland Police Association had offered to host the negotiations with the city behind closed doors at the Hilton on the dime of the Portland Police Association so that they can get away with backdoor deals, sneak in less accountability for the police by holding no severe consequences for police when they do mess up on the job.
Well, so what do you hope to see here down here today?
I hope that City Hall finally takes into account the fact that the community is angry at the fact that people are being killed in the police in the community by the police. The fact that killer cops are getting away with pulling their gun in the middle of road rage incidents and then walking away scot-free.
They create a factor of fear within the public and create a faction of, well, we can't go to them for safety, but I think it's because of the social segregation that's starting to exist in this country.
What do you mean by social segregation?
The classes, you know, if you're rich or the working poor, the poor, I think they have different laws for different classes of people, and that's what I mean by social segregation. Different laws pertain to different social status.
Again, this is Sarah Libby.
Training is not going to get us out of this situation. I don't think that you can train out a philosophy and way of being in an institution. There is a fundamental problem with policing in this country. I think that not only the tragic murders of these people in Portland, but this isn't just a situation in Portland, Oregon. Oscar Grant was shot and killed by a uniformed officer in Oakland, California in the first hours of 2009. Tragic situation. He had his hands cuffed behind his back. He was completely subdued. Mm-hmm. and this officer drew a gun and shot him in the back. There was a whole BART load train full of witnesses that saw this, that have put this up on public media, that have spoken up, that have criticized this, and the community in Oakland has done an amazing job to try to bring this to justice. And that officer is actually going on trial in LA. I think it's June 14th. Mm-hmm. Oscar Grant, a young African-American man, this story is not unique, unfortunately. It's like, you know, the deaths of Amadou Diallo and Sean Bell in mm-hmm. New York City. This is a problem. This is a problem about a force that they're using the greatest degree of force to address any problem because that's the type of power and training that they're given. Mm-hmm. And that is never going to result in real community care or our needs getting met when the first contact that somebody has with a police officer mm-hmm. is a taser, is right. a gun, that's is right. a beating. And this happens differently for different people, right? White That's people right. with money and privilege and who look like they have money and privilege right. get different treatment than people who don't look like they have money and privilege. People of color, especially young African-American men, it is a risk for them to interact with the police, in my mind. I think that queer communities as well, mm-hmm. genderqueer folks have received a lot of either mistreatment or non-response by the police. And the Portland Police Bureau also showed that women are still oftentimes subject to sexual harassment and really inappropriate sexually aggressive treatment by the cops.
Again, the Fire Fresh Hour rally at Portland City Hall.
As a citizen of Portland, I'm tired of what is going on with the police department. I feel that there's no accountability with the police department. And in the absence of authority governing over the police department, I think the people have to take to the street and organize amongst themselves to develop a community that is not afraid of the police so that we can police ourselves and have police-free zones. Similar to what Red and Black did, they showed us that we have our rights and the right to police our own area and our own spaces.
Putting pressure on city council, putting pressure on the mayor is really important because what's happening now is just business as usual. Officer Mike Reese, who's promoted to the new police chief position, there's some complaints that have come up against him because there was another officer on the job at the Bureau who made a complaint against Officer Kyle Nice, yes. Who had this public menacing incident with a gun. The officer who brought up this complaint was then immediately moved to a different position. I think that city government is just changing the window dressing. They're just making a shift in order to make it seem like they're doing something. And we want real accountability now. We want some actual change, and we want people to face consequences for their actions. The public is really concerned about this, and people have more criticisms of the Portland Police Bureau than I have time to list here today. You can contact the Fire Fresh Hour campaign at 503-816-9205 or email us at firefreshhour@gmail.com.
We'd like to thank our guests Andrew Barney, George Ciccarello Marr, Aaron Carter, and John Langley. Special thanks also to Will Munger for his recordings from the Fire Fresh Hour rally and KBOO's Voices from the Edge. We used excerpts from their interview with Sarah Libby on tonight's show.
Circle A Radio comes to you each first and third Wednesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. You can contact us through the KBOO website, kboo.fm/circlearadio, or email us at circlearadio@gmail.com. Our next show airs July 7th. Thanks for listening.